Welcome to the PRI Review, brought to you by the Population Research Institute. I'm your host, Christopher Mannion. Today we bring you a presentation by PRI's founder and president, Stephen Mosier. In a recent address in Wisconsin, Mr. Mosier gave an eloquent and moving account of his conversion long ago when he left behind a promising role as a secular social scientist at a prestigious American university to become a leader in the international fight for life and liberty of the most vulnerable in every society, especially the unborn. For many of you, Steve's reminiscences will be a welcome opportunity to reflect on your memories of PRI's early days, when Steve first began his work with Father Paul Marx, whom Pope St. John Paul called the Apostle of Life. Others might be hearing his eyewitness account, a unique perspective on the history of the pro-life movement, for the first time. I encourage you not only to listen to Steve's talk, but to share it, because you might well find that others who hear it for the first time might resolve to reorder their principles, their priorities and their lives in the same fashion that Steve did in the faraway rural fields and villages of communist China. We now turn to Steve Mosier's talk, where he begins his right to life story.
Now let me go back to the beginning. The pro-life story, at least my part in the pro-life story, began in 1979 when I arrived elatedly in a Chinese village in South China. I was elated to be there because I was the first American social scientist allowed into the People's Republic of China. I was finishing up my dissertation, getting my PhD at Stanford University, and there I was on the ground in China, the first American to be on the ground in China, be allowed to do research for 30 years. Within a few months of my arrival, however, the one-child policy began, and my elation disappeared because I witnessed mothers 3 and 6 and 9 months pregnant being rounded up by local communist officials and charged with a crime. What crime, you ask? Well, they were charged with the crime of being pregnant without government permission. I actually have copies from that time of the arrest warrants that were issued. And in the block where you wrote the crime for which these women were being arrested was written the word huayun, which means pregnant in China. You see, these women had the misfortune to get pregnant at a time when the Chinese government was going to radically clamp down on childbearing. And they were caught right in the middle. Because before March of 1980, it had been legal to conceive a second child or third or fourth child, and all of a sudden under the new regulations these women were told their pregnancies conceived 3 and 6 months and 9 months before, when it was legal to have second, third and fourth children, were now illegal, and those pregnancies must be terminated. They were told their babies must be aborted. I went with these women as they were rounded up by local Communist Party officials. I went with them as they were taken to a commune dormitory where they were locked up for days or weeks at a time in a kind of holding tank where they were subjected to morning to night propaganda lectures. What we should call properly, its proper name would be brainwashing. Brainwashing was invented by the Chinese Communist Party in the 1930s. And they still do it today, and they're very, very good at it. These young, pregnant, scared mothers, most of whom were in their early 20s, denied visits from their families, denied visits from their husbands, were no match for the seasoned Communist Party officials who would come in and harangue them and threaten them from morning till night, telling them they had no choice but to get an abortion, telling them that if they refused an abortion, at the end of the day, they would be taken by force to the local abortion clinic and aborted anyway. One by one, these young women succumbed to this pressure, and one by one they were taken to the abortion clinic. I went with them when they went. I was present in the operating room when doctors performed cesarean section abortions on these women. Not just ordinary doctors. You see, the Communist Party officials were smart enough to realize that the local doctors were oftentimes relatives or at least friends of these women. And so they might disobey orders. So the Communist Party brought in military doctors trained in military discipline to do these surgeries. And these women, 6, 7, 8, 9 months pregnant, were opened up like tin cans. The mother's body was actually cut open to get at the baby. The baby had received a poison injection a day or two before. Most of the babies were born dead. Some were born nearly dead and soon died. I was horrified to witness this, as you can imagine. I could not believe my eyes when these dead babies began being extracted from the desecrated wombs of their mothers. I remember one baby being pulled out. I think it was a little girl, and of course already dead. It changed my life. It changed my life in two ways. It changed my life because, first of all, it made clear to me in a way that no biology textbook and even no ultrasound could ever have made clear to me what happened in an abortion. Obviously, an abortion was the taking of a human life. I'd seen it before my own eyes. Obviously, a little son of Adam, a little daughter of Eve, was being sacrificed in an abortion. The baby was being killed, the mother was being wounded. Abortion was not a question I'd thought about much until that time. Afterwards, it was something that I found it hard not to think about. I left China with the cries of women, these hurting women, these women who'd been forcibly aborted, ringing in my ears. The other thing that happened in that operating room was that I realized that much of what I had been taught at Stanford University was fake news. Much of what I taught had been taught at Stanford University was untrue. I'd been taught at Stanford that abortion was a woman's choice. Well, these women in China had no choice. Had they had a choice, they would have chosen life. I'd been taught that it was nothing but a clump of cells. Obviously, what I had seen showed me it was much, much more than that. It was a tiny human being, weaker, incapable of defending itself, but worthy of our protection nonetheless. I also found out that I had been lied to about the existence of evil. You see, at our elite institutions of learning, our high temples of humor, secular humanism, as it were, people there, for the most part, don't believe in the existence of evil. They don't believe in the existence of absolutes at all. They believe that ethics are situational. They believe that morality is relative. They believe that everything is shades of gray, right? There is no absolute evil, there is no absolute good. If there's no absolute good, there's no God. If there's no absolute evil, there's no devil. Well, I had been in the room when I saw an act of absolute evil committed before my very eyes. I could imagine no greater evil than the killing of a nearly full-term healthy baby, nearly ready to be born, by lethal injection and the grievous wounding of its mother. And so I became convinced in that operating room of the existence of evil. I recoiled in horror from the abyss that had opened up before me, and I did the natural thing. I think I began to seek the good. Now, God is ultimately the source of all goodness, all truth, and all beauty. And if you seek the good, you will eventually be led to God. I'm a slow learner. It took me several years and the help of my lovely wife, Vera, but I eventually got there. And because I got there, Andrew and my other children got here. So. So I returned to the United States convinced that I had to do something about what I had seen in China, that I had to do all I could to end the forced abortion and forced sterilization. I was shocked to learn that we had been funding that policy of forced abortion and forced sterilization, not directly from our foreign aid agency, but indirectly through the UN Population Fund. And I set out to work with people in the Reagan administration to cut that funding, and we succeeded. But I also returned to the United States thinking that what I had seen in China run by a communist party, in China, which was a one-party dictatorship, in China where they had no Bill of Rights, I came back convinced that it could not possibly happen here. You see how naive I was at that point. I returned to the United States and began studying the abortion question here and found to my horror that abortion was legal up to the point of childbirth, that there was no difference under the law between the laws of China, which allowed abortion up to the point of childbirth, and the laws of the United States under Roe v. Wade, which allowed the same thing. I realized that as bleak and as full as the killing fields in China were, that we had had killing fields in the United States since 1973. And not only that, that we were funding Planned Parenthood's industrial-sized killing fields with our own tax dollars, and therefore we were all, in a sense, complicit in the killing. And I also realized one more thing. I realized that China, being a one-party dictatorship, had never given its people a choice as to whether abortion should be legal, had never put the matter of the one-child policy to a vote, had never allowed Chinese women to decide for themselves whether to carry their pregnancies to term. We, on the other hand, were and are a democracy. We elected the men who appointed the judges who originally allowed the abortionists with their long-bladed knives to go into the sanctity of the womb and take unborn human life. So in a sense, we're doubly responsible. First of all, in the legal justification of this horrific act, and secondly, in the act itself. And you can hold the Chinese women responsible really for neither, because they didn't vote in the one-child policy, they didn't elect the men who put it in place, and they certainly weren't responsible for the final bloody killing because it was forced on them. So we have even more, I think, to answer for. I learned after I came back to the United States about the U.S. State Department's efforts to coerce foreign governments into legalizing abortion. You know, a lot of people don't understand that under the Obama administration and under the Clinton administration, that one of the goals of our foreign policy has been to promote abortion on demand everywhere and always, and that our tax dollars have been used for that purpose. In 2013, for example, in the middle of the Obama administration, there was $32 million spent around the world to lobby foreign governments into legalizing abortion. Imagine the arrogance of U.S. officials in the Philippines, a Catholic country, in Peru, a Catholic country, countries that have on the books laws that define life as beginning at conception. Peru actually has it written into its constitution that life begins at conception. Imagine the arrogance of U.S. foreign officials going to visit government officials there and saying, you got it wrong. Your democratic process is flawed because abortion is a human right, and you have to legalize abortion. And by the way, unless and until you do legalize abortion in violation of the laws of your country and the wishes of your people, unless you overturn those democratically instituted laws and revoke the democracy that instituted them, we will not give you any foreign aid for anything. We won't help you with roads or bridges or food aid or anything else. So we use foreign aid as a weapon to try to overturn pro-life laws that were passed by democratic legislatures in different countries. That's not what America should be about in the world. And yet that's what we've been doing for a long, long time. Of course, we spend $1 billion a year, roughly, promoting population control around the world, funding population control programs through the UN Population Fund and through other organizations like International Planned Parenthood Federation, going into countries where we lobby for the legalization of abortion. But not just that, we promote abortion, we actually fund organizations that perform abortions, oftentimes in violation of the laws in which they're operating, but using our tax money. Now, to be sure, since I returned to the United States way back in the 1980s, we won some victories thanks to President Reagan. In 1984, we put in place the Mexico City policy so that NGOs who receive federal funding have to certify they won't perform, promote, or lobby for the legalization of abortion in other countries. Well, that policy stayed in place under Bush 1. As soon as William Jefferson Clinton got in office, he threw it out the window. We managed to put it back in place with Bush 2, and as soon as Barack Hussein Obama got in power, he threw it out the window. So we've gone back and forth for years. We've never been able to write these pro-life advances into settled law. We now, at long last, have that opportunity. We have a generational opportunity to write into the law protection for the unborn at home and abroad. And I believe we have to fight like never before to accomplish just that. Now, we have already seen some victories. Not long after President Trump was sworn into office, he signed an executive order reinstituting the Mexico City policy. Except it wasn't President Reagan's Mexico City policy. It was far broader and far more inclusive and far more powerful than anything we'd had before, because the original Mexico City policy just applied to the Global Health Fund of USAID, about $1 billion. That's not chump change, but it's not all of what goes overseas. The new Mexico City policy applies to any federal money from any federal agency that goes overseas. It cannot go to Planned Parenthood. It cannot go to Marie Stopes. It cannot go to any organization that performs, promotes, or lobbies for the legalization of abortion. They're done. But it gets even better, because combined with the new Mexico City policy is what we call the Kemp-Kasten Amendment. I met with Bob Kasten back in 1984 and with Jack Kemp. And the result of the work that a lot of people, including myself, did on China and elsewhere was to pass the Kemp-Kasten Amendment, which forbids any U.S. money from going to any country or organization that participates in the support or management of a program of forced abortion or forced sterilization. So you do forced abortion or forced sterilization, you're disqualified from funding. Again, this is a policy that's gone back and forth. It's been in place under Bush. It was thrown out under Obama and Clinton. Well, that too, the Kemp-Kasten Amendment, was written into the new Mexico City policy. And what that means is the United Nations Population Fund, which is used to getting $30, $40, $50 million of your money every year, is not going to get a single penny under the Trump administration. But of course, there's only so much you can do with executive orders. You've got to write these things into law so that they will be there in the federal code for all time to come. And we're working to do just that. You all know, of course, about the great battle that we're facing to reconstitute the Supreme Court and finally, how many decades after Roe versus Wade, put in place on the court a pro-life majority that will overturn that horrendous, horrendous decision. You know, the founding fathers of the United States were geniuses, and I believe they were divinely inspired as well, because we have the oldest written constitution in the world. We're still a relatively young country by the standards of China and the standards of Europe, and yet we have the oldest constitution in the world, which has a brilliantly designed system of checks and balances. Those who drafted the Constitution did not want to escape one tyrant, only to fall into another one of their own making. So they carefully divided power between three separate but equal branches of government. You all know that. The legislature would pass laws, the judiciary would interpret them, and the executive would carry them out, and they would all make sure that the other didn't overstep its bounds. Well, that worked pretty well for a couple of centuries. Then the unexpected happened. An abortion case came before the Supreme Court, and a majority of the justices decided they would write their own prejudices into the ruling. And so they invented a right to an abortion. Justice Harry Blackmun, who wrote the majority opinion, was careful to concoct a tissue of rationalizations to hide the fact that he and his colleagues were simply legislating from the bench. But it was clear to legal scholars that was exactly what they were doing. My friend Judge Robert Bork, who's no longer with us, often remarked that Roe versus Wade was an act of raw judicial tyranny. And since Roe versus Wade, of course, we have seen ever more acts of raw judicial tyranny by people who look like judges. They wear the black robes and they sit on the Supreme Court, but they don't act like judges because they're no longer judging based on the law, they're judging based on their own prejudices and left-wing biases. So, we have Judge Gorsuch, who needs to be confirmed. This is going to be a battle, like everything in Washington is. And everybody needs to get engaged in that battle. Everybody needs to be, not just emails are generally ignored in Washington because they're too easy to send. You need to pick up the phone and call. You need to write letters. We need to continue to put pressure on not just the few remaining moderate Democrats who may be won over, but on those who claim to be pro-life, because I will tell you there are a lot of members of the House and Senate who are much more pro-life when they come back to their districts in Wisconsin than they are in Washington, D.C., when they seem to forget what they always mentioned in their stump speeches. Of course, there are some really good ones like Congressman Chris Smith, Senator Tom Cotton of Arkansas, who would really sacrifice their political career for the babies. They would lay down on the road and die for the babies. Most of the politicians, however, have other things on their mind than pro-life issues, principally getting reelected. And this is the best job they've ever had, and they want to keep it forever. So we need to be pressing the Senate to act on quickly on Judge Gorsuch to name him to the Supreme Court. You see, this is a test. Gorsuch alone will not change the balance on the Supreme Court. We will still have four solid pro-life votes, because his vote will make up for the vote of Justice Scalia, now lost. We will still have four committed pro-abortion votes, and we'll still have Justice Anthony Kennedy sort of waffling in the middle. We're never clear on where he's going to go on any given issue. So it won't take just one. It'll take a second one. It'll take a third one. But if we win hands down on Judge Gorsuch, we will pave the way for the next one. And then, with legislation that may be written, I understand, here in Washington, I'm in Washington all the time, but tonight I'm in Wisconsin. With legislation that's written here in Wisconsin, that legislation may find its way through the federal judiciary up to the Supreme Court in time to meet a solid pro-life majority in the Supreme Court. And we will finally be able to overturn the act of raw judicial tyranny that is Roe versus Wade. Now, there's a lot more that we have to accomplish, but I am more hopeful than I have ever been. The reason I joined President Trump's pro-life coalition and his Catholic coalition is because of promises that he made to us during the campaign. And we remind him of these promises, and we believe he's a man of his word. Let me go through them very quickly. He said, "I am committed to nominating pro-life justices to the U.S. Supreme Court." I think we've seen that one in the process of being carried out. Quote, "I will work to support the dignity of human life from conception to natural dignified death." We'll call him on that one as well. Quote, "I am committed to defunding Planned Parenthood as long as they continue to perform abortions." When will Planned Parenthood ever stop doing abortions? The answer is never. They will be doing their abortions with the last federal dollar that they ever get. And after that, they will still try to continue to do them with donations from the Gates Foundation and Warren Buffett, but on a much smaller scale. And having lost the veneer of respectability that comes with federal funding. You see, if you cut off their federal funding, that in effect is the American people saying, we don't like what you're doing and we're not going to support it. And that will have an impact as well. President Trump also say, quote, "I am committed to making the Hyde Amendment permanent law to protect taxpayers from having to pay for abortions." Quote, "I am committed to signing into law the Pain-Capable Unborn Child Protection Act, which would end painful long-term abortions or late-term abortions nationwide. If I'm elected president," well, he has been, "I will sign the First Amendment Defense Act to protect the deeply held religious beliefs of Americans of all faiths." Quote, "I will sign the Conscience Protection Act and make sure that it is enforced." The Little Sisters of the Poor, by the way, should not have to buy health policy that includes contraceptives. So these are the promises made by someone, I think, who spent a lifetime trying to keep his promises. But there's a lot of work yet to be done. Most of the positions that the president, any president, can appoint in Washington, D.C. are still unfilled. There are only a couple hundred positions out of the 4,100 where people have been nominated. And every time someone is nominated, there's an immediate attack from the left against them and against their qualifications. The party of abortion is doing everything it can to slow down the process of getting good pro-life people in places like the State Department, the Foreign Aid Agency, and other agencies and departments of the federal government. And they're doing this quite deliberately, because every day that there is no pro-life appointee at USAID, for example, the career bureaucrats who are there will be dragging their feet and not enforcing the new executive order reintroducing the Mexico City policy. You know how that works. The bureaucrats, the ones who've been there for decades, are used to running things their own way. They refer to political appointees as the summer help. Well, they're here today, and then in a couple of years they're gone, but we're here permanently. We're the deep state, we're the permanent bureaucracy. In order to make change happen, in order to make sure that these good executive orders are enforced, in order to make sure that good pro-life laws are not just passed, but actually carried out, you've got to have people in place. And that's why the party of abortion is delaying the confirmation as long as they can, because they want the permanent bureaucracy, which is allied with them, to remain in power. So that's the battle that we're fighting in Washington, D.C. For the first time in a generation, for the first time in my lifetime as a pro-life activist, we have a chance to make fundamental changes and to put pro-life laws in place throughout the United States.
You have been listening to the presentation which PRI President Stephen Mosher recently gave to a pro-life gathering in Wisconsin. We urge you to encourage your friends to hear it and share it. And as always, we ask for and appreciate your vital support for the work of the Population Research Institute. This has been PRI Review from pop.org. Thanks for listening.